Welcome to Borderlines, a podcast mostly about Canadian immigration law. I'm Stephen Murins. In today's episode, Deanna and I are joined by Gerald Chen, a white-collar criminal defense lawyer and a partner at Stockwoods LLP in Toronto. We do a deep dive into recent developments in Canadian privacy law, with a focus on the expectation of electronic privacy that Canadians can expect from the state. Gerald provides an overview of several recent Supreme Court decisions, including on topics ranging from whether the police can access text messages or IP addresses without a warrant, whether the police can take our phones and pretend to be us when texting someone, and online anonymity. We also discuss the intersection of immigration and privacy law, including whether and when CBSA can search your phone at the border, what documents visa officers can demand from applicants, and what limitations there are on immigration officials when they demand documents from employers to ensure compliance with the Temporary Foreign Worker Program. Once again, if you like the show, please leave a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts, and I hope you enjoy. We are joined today by Gerald Chen, who is a privacy lawyer at Stockwoods LLP. Gerald focuses on administrative and civil litigation and has been named one of the top 25 most influential lawyers in Canada, which is pretty cool, and one of the top 50 trial lawyers. So thanks, thanks for coming on.
No, thank you for having me. I will add criminal to that description because that probably is more of my practice at any given time than administrative and civil. But I try to keep a broad base as much as possible. Keeps life interesting.
But you, so it's your white collar crime and regulatory defense for the most part?
It depends on the, you know, the day or the week. but for the most part, that's the focus. Although I still maintain a portion of my practice dedicated to, you know, more traditional forms of criminal defense work. So I'll have, I've got
Keeps
a homicide appeal on the go. Sex assaults, you know, your day-to-day stuff as well.
And
it's
so
interesting,
the
just having a broad platform like that just means you don't lose touch with any part of the process. So that's very interesting.
Yeah, and I do think there are connections between different areas of the law that sometimes when we end up practicing in silos, we lose sight of. And so I think it's, even aside from my more selfish interest in just learning about a broad range of areas, I think it's helpful to be able to spot these connections from time to time.
For sure. I mean, we're trying to do the same thing with the podcast, which is why when Steve saw this decision, he immediately sees the intersections and is like, okay, let's bring this into the conversation.
Well, and it's also, there have been a few criminal defense lawyers over the years who have told me that, in their opinion, the immigration bar kind of just accepts things the way they are too much and as the department presents them too much, and that we should be looking at other areas to kind of see how things operate there. And one of the areas that is probably growing of increasing concern in immigration is privacy. And so, yeah, when I did see that recent Supreme Court case and then did some researching on privacy law, your name came up, and I think this could be a fascinating conversation on how privacy law works in the non-immigration context and things that immigration practitioners might, you know, want to look out for in general principles that emerge elsewhere.
I think privacy is a great example of one of those areas where worlds collide, because so much of the privacy law jurisprudence has built up in the criminal charter context, but you know it has carryover into whether immigration or other forms of administrative law, or you know purely private law like employment law and other areas. There's a lot of carryover and a lot of it, but you know a lot of it has borrowed at the, I think, conceptually from what's developed in the criminal context.
And in the criminal context, does that mainly stem from Section 8 of the Charter, or are there other kind of constitutional areas that give rise to privacy rights?
Almost entirely from Section 8 of the Charter. Whenever the state, I mean, mainly police in the criminal context, are investigating crime, they're at some point in the course of their investigation gathering information or intruding upon spaces where we have a reasonable expectation of privacy. And so that engages Section 8 of the Charter, the right to be secure against unreasonable search and seizure. And it's interesting because, I mean, the word privacy doesn't appear in Section 8 or in the Charter, but it is the fact that the Supreme Court of Canada has made that the touchstone for when the police or when the state is engaging in a search. They're engaging in a search when there is a reasonable expectation of privacy that has, that is at issue.
And so the Supreme Court has had a few published decisions on this, and it probably maybe makes sense to go in chronological order. And I think,
Sure.
were you involved? You were involved in Maraca, am I?
I was involved in Maraca as counsel for an intervener.
Yeah.
And that's been the role that I've had in a number of these Section 8 cases at the Supreme Court of Canada. I'm often counsel for either the BC Civil Liberties Association, which is who was my client in Maraca, or other groups such as the Criminal Lawyers Association.
And so the issue there was, if I understand it, whether the police could compel TELUS to provide copies of people's text messages without a warrant.
So slightly different. So that was an issue in a case called TELUS that actually predated
Oh, okay.
Merica. And that's actually one, and it's funny you hit on that because TELUS is one of the privacy law cases that actually does not deal with, it doesn't flow from Section 8 of the Charter. But although the principles are very much colored by the Section 8 jurisprudence, TELUS was a statutory interpretation case. Because the police relied on the specific search power called the general warrant power, which is kind of a basket clause power. If they don't know where else to find a power in the criminal code, they go to the general warrant power. So there they were asking TELUS going forward every 24 hours to produce to the police text messages between two individuals. And so it was a prospective order that they were seeking. To compel TELUS to comply with. And the whole issue there was simply a statutory one. Is that a general warrant power, or is that akin to what we traditionally think of as a wiretap, right? Because wiretaps are where the police are intercepting our phone calls. You're getting private communications between two people on a go-forward basis. And TELUS said this is essentially the text messaging equivalent of a wiretap, and so you should be required to go under that different section of the
Yeah.
criminal code, which matters because it's a more stringent provision. The safeguards are stronger because it's considered a more intrusive and invasive police technique. And TELUS won the argument in that case. The Supreme Court said, you're right, this is functionally equivalent to a wiretap. And so, police, you're going to have to comply with this more restrictive set of safeguards that are in place to protect privacy.
Yeah, and you wrote a paper on that decision, and that was, I mean, when I was reading it, the thing I hadn't realized until these cases that all our text messages are stored.
Yeah, well, it's no longer the case actually. At the time of TELUS and some of the related litigation, the different telcos had different practices. And I think at the time, TELUS maybe have been the only one that stored copies of our text messages in their infrastructure for just a very brief period of time to facilitate troubleshooting. From what I understand now, although I stand to be corrected, the telcos no longer store, none of the telcos in Canada store copies of our text messages. Although, the same principles could easily map over into email, right? I mean, Gmail has obviously stores copies of our emails on their server. Other instant messaging platforms like Facebook Instant Messenger, et cetera, and who knows what other platforms are going to develop going forward. So, I think there are always going to be circumstances where you may have a third party intermediary that does have a copy of what we perceive to be our private communication.
And so what was the decision in Maraca?
So Maraca, it was kind of a variation on TELUS. It wasn't a statutory interpretation case. It was a Section 8 of the charter case. The police did not go to the telco. What happened was that they searched one person's phone for the text. They actually searched both parties' phones. You had two parties, Mr. Merrick and Mr. Winchester, who were parties.
This is they searched their physical phones?
Their physical phones. Yeah. So they were both parties to what was suspected to be a firearms trafficking transaction. And the police searched one of their phones. There were some, real Section 8 issues as to whether they properly complied with the law in searching that person's phone. So then they get the same text messages from the other's phone. And what the Crown argued was, well, you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy. You do if it's your own phone being searched, because it's your device, it's your property. But where we get your messages from someone else's phone, because you've sent them to that person's phone, you don't have standing. You don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy to assert in that case, because it wasn't your phone. We got it from someone else's device. When you hit send, you should have known that it was out of your control by that point, and you don't have a basis for complaint. And so the Supreme Court of Canada looked at that question, and they really could have looked at it in one of two ways. They could have adopted the Crown view, which was to think of this as a search of a device, a physical place, right? And so if it's not your device, how can you complain that your privacy was violated? Or they could have and did, in fact, look at this differently and say, no, this is not a search of a device per se. The police weren't interested in the hardware or even in, the entirety of the contents of that hardware. What they were interested in was the text messaging conversation, the electronic conversation. And that conversation is one in which you have two parties who are equal participants. And so regardless of where the police get at that conversation from, whether your phone or the other person's phone, you both have a basis for a complaint. You both have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the contents of your communications. And so they really, much like TELUS, but now under the rubric of Section 8 of the Charter, really viewed the issue in a purposive kind of functional way to say, what's really at stake here? It's our electronic conversations. That's how people communicate in the modern age. They used to just talk on the phone. Now people text often more, quite frequently more often than they talk, depending on the generation, probably. And so your expectations of privacy shouldn't be any different just because you're using this new medium of communication, even though the medium by its very nature creates a verbatim record of the communication.
And is that because the police were searching person's A's phone already kind of without their consent? Like if that person goes to the police and says, hey, look at all my texts, that's evidence that person B did offenses. Do different principles arise, or would they still need, like, what would the principle from Maraca be in terms of if A is voluntarily going to the police saying, look at all these texts?
Yeah. You've hit on a great question, because that remains one of the most fraught, unsettled areas of the law when it comes to police investigations and the text messaging. There's no simple answer to that. In the immediate aftermath of Maraca, many people thought the answer was as follows, and I continue to think that it is, but it's very much in flux, which is once you recognize that both parties have an expectation of privacy in the conversation, we know from previous case law that, namely a decision called Cole, that you can't have third-party waiver, right? Like one person can't waive another person's Section 8 rights. So if both parties to the communication have equal Section 8 rights in that conversation, then I think you've got a pretty convincing argument that one can't unilaterally waive the privacy rights of the other, such that you can't voluntarily disclose that conversation to the police. The police can still get it, but it may mean that they have to get a warrant before they can receive it. Now that I get that sounds simple the way that I've described it. There are a number of complications that have arisen in the subsequent case law. I think mainly because of a discomfort that many judges have with the notion that someone can't go into the police station and say, I was threatened, or I was a victim of child luring, or any other, pick your offense that you can commit over text messaging, right? And here's the evidence of it, and simply hand it over to the police. So different arguments have been made to try to allow the police to take those without getting a warrant. One argument that was made for a while was, well, when the police are passively receiving information as opposed to actively seeking it out, that's not actually a search or seizure. That argument is no longer tenable, I think, because there was a subsequent Ontario Court of Appeals, at least in Ontario, the Ontario Court of Appeal in a case called Lambert, said that that's an illusory distinction. Whether the police are actively seizing or passively receiving, there's still state action there. And it's all that, the only question is whether there's a reasonable expectation of privacy. So I don't think that argument is available any longer. There's another line of thinking that where the conversation itself is the actus reus of a crime, right? So where the conversation itself is the crime, it's not just evidence. In Morocco, it was evidence of firearms trafficking. But if you threaten someone, then that conversation, that's the threat, and that's the offense. The line of thinking is, well, there you can't have a reasonable expectation of privacy any longer in that conversation. That, I think, has its own conceptual problems, because under Section 8 of the Charter, the courts have long said we need to take a content-neutral approach. Mm-hmm. That is, whether there is an expectation of privacy can't be made to depend on what the specific text message says.
Right.
And there's a very practical reason for that, right? The practical reason is the whole point of Section 8 of the Charter is to prevent, to be preventative, to prevent violations of privacy before they happen. So the police have to know in advance, if I'm going to search a phone for text messages, right, or I'm going to receive these text messages, I have to know before I look at the messages whether there's a reasonable expectation of privacy, whether Section 8 of the Charter applies such that I have to get a warrant. If you make it depend on what the message says, well, you're inviting the police to read it all. And by
and
that point,
make that privacy, determination. You know, exactly. It's an,
right.
It's a moot point.
And yeah, privacy once lost can seldom be regained, as the court has said. So if the cat's out of the bag, the right's already been violated at that point, and it's too late.
And this scenario arises in all sorts of immigration contexts, whether it's people doing complaints to the CBSA tip line that can lead to someone's deportation, to employers who are facing compliance audits where an employee may be providing texts. So it's interesting to see that it's a live issue in all sorts of areas of the law, where it's probably more litigated in those other areas of the law.
Yeah.
And so we go from that case to the case that led to this episode and how I found you, which was, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correctly, Bykovets?
I've been saying Bykovets, but I may be
Bykovets?
Mispronouncing it too. Yeah, yeah. Well, one of us will figure it out at some point.
And so this case involves whether the police need a warrant to get someone's IP address.
Yes. Yeah, it's a fascinating case. And really, to understand this case properly, I think you have to go back to 2014 or 15. I get the years mixed up, but previous decision from the Supreme Court of Canada called Spencer. I mean, the mid 2010s really were sort of a golden age of the Supreme Court developing the principles for digital privacy and data privacy.
Yeah.
Spencer was a case where the police had the IP address already. It was a child pornography investigation. And they became aware that child pornography was being shared. I think it was with LimeWire, which no one, you know, uses anymore. The technology becomes outdated so quickly. By the time these cases get to the Supreme Court of Canada, because litigation takes so long, no one's ever heard of the technologies any longer. But it was a file sharing program, and the police were able to detect that there's child pornography being shared, and here's the IP address. They were able to publicly access the IP address that was associated with the child pornography. So they had the IP address, but what they didn't have was who's the internet subscriber that's associated with that IP address. So for that final key, they had to go to the telco and say, tell us the name and address information of the subscriber who is associated with this IP address at this date, this time. And Spencer said, for that final key, you need a production order warrant. You need Section 8 of the Charter applies, because that's the key to unlocking the world in which you can determine where someone was on the internet at a particular time. And so Spencer was all about the anonymity that we should be entitled to expect when we're online, and how anonymity is a critical part of privacy, as we should understand it. That was a groundbreaking decision. And that is the kind of immediate predecessor in terms of properly understanding Bykovitz. Bykovitz really does, in some ways it goes a step farther, in other ways it really just draws on the Spencer reasoning. Because much like Spencer, Bykovitz is very much about online privacy, right? We should be able to go places on the internet, search for things on the internet, go to websites without the state having unfettered access to that information. And so that's very much what's driving the opinion of Bykovitz. Where it goes a step further is it says, well, not only does the subscriber information, the name and address, not only is that protected by Section 8, but so too is the IP address. So in Bykovitz, the police were not able to get the IP address without going to a third-party intermediary. It was a fraudulent transactions investigation. They went to a third-party payment processing company and said, can you give us the IP addresses for these particular transactions? And it was that investigative step that in Bykovitz, the Supreme Court says, there's also Section 8 protection for that. And so it does go a step further in that it kind of, in a way, it moves the Section 8 protection a step earlier in the police investigation. At the same time, though, if you read the rationale for the court's opinion, it's very much driven by this evidence that, well, sometimes it's not the customer name and address that's the key to unlocking everything. Sometimes it's the IP address itself that's the key to unlocking everything. Because if you know an IP address, there are ways for the police to determine the individual behind it without taking any further steps involving any further telcos. They can correlate it to other online activities, like what social media sites you went to, right? What Gmail account you then logged into. And in that, that's another way for them to put the pieces together. And so I think the court's always concerned about what is the key to unlocking this all for the police. And wherever that is, that critical piece is what they're going to extend Section 8 protection to, because what they don't want is the police having free rein to figure out, or the state having free rein to figure out what we're doing on the internet. They want some control there, and the control is judicial oversight. Right. The control is prior judicial authorization.
So I haven't done criminal law since law school. What is the, like, a lot of this involves just they have to get a warrant. How cumbersome is that? Like, are we talking now like this will delay the police by a day? Are they likely to be refused? Like, what is the warrant getting process?
So it's, look, there will always be arguments that it's, from one side of the courtroom, that it's too cumbersome and it's slowing us down. In reality, yes, it's an extra step in the investigation. No, I don't think it creates this impractical obstacle. And part of the reason for that is there's so many both exceptions and flexibilities built into the process. So in order to get a warrant, the police have to swear what's called an information to obtain, essentially an affidavit, right, that lays out the grounds of the application. They have to establish reasonable grounds to believe that there is a crime and there's evidence of a crime. Sometimes if it's for information over which we have less of an expectation of privacy, a lower standard applies, reasonable grounds to suspect. But whatever the standard, they have to lay out, this is what our investigation is about. Here's the evidence we've gathered to lead us to this point, and this is why we want the IP address or the customer name and information or the text messages. And that's not an overly lengthy document. The Supreme Court has said, You have to make full, frank, and fair disclosure, but you don't have to give us every detail of your investigation. Just give us what's material to the issuing justice. So yes, it takes some time to write that up, but at the same time, the law provides for so many for a number of options for the police. If you can't find the justice of the peace in person, you can apply for what's called a telewarrant and just do it over the phone. That's another option that's possible. As well, if there truly is an emergency, right? If there's imminent danger to public safety, there's the imminent loss or destruction of evidence concerns, there is the well-established doctrine of exigent circumstances. So even if a warrant is typically required, the police will not have to get one if they can show there were exigent circumstances. And that's actually what a case called Campbell, that was just heard at the Supreme Court of Canada a few weeks ago, deals with, is exigent circumstances kind of in the digital privacy, data privacy realm.
So what are the facts in that one? Like, what's the issue?
Yeah, so Campbell really builds on, sort of, to move us away from Vykovitz for a moment, Campbell really builds on America. So Campbell's a text messaging case. But instead of the police simply going into someone's device and scrolling through the messages, the police, they arrest person A, they go into person A's device, they both look at the messages with person B, which is what Merica involved, but they then take over the device and continue texting, right? So now they're not just retrieving past messages, which is really an act of gathering evidence. Now they are creating future messages. So it's a fundamentally different police technique. And so the question, a number of questions arose in Campbell. One question is, okay, it's sort of a threshold question. Is there an expectation of privacy here where the target is talking directly to the police officer unknowingly?
Unknowingly,
They think it was a fentanyl sale, and so they think that they're arranging for the sale of fentanyl. They're actually talking to a police officer who's taken over the device, and so that's really a America type question, slight variation on it. But is there an expectation of privacy in these circumstances? The second question is, this is kind of a TELUS type question, which is, okay, you're not just retrieving past messages. You are creating in real time messages with this target. Is that a regular, search for which a regular search warrant is sufficient? Or is that akin to a wiretap? Is that akin to an undercover officer getting on the phone with somebody or talking to them in person and wearing a hidden microphone and recording in real time conversations? That's another question that arises in Campbell. And then the third question is the one that gets to what we were just talking about, which is, were there exigent circumstances? The Court of Appeal in this case, said, yes, there's an expectation of privacy, but the police didn't have to get a warrant here because there were exigent circumstances. They were concerned with fentanyl making its way onto the streets. It's a deadly, a lethal drug. And so that justified not getting a warrant. Now that holding has come under challenge in the Supreme Court of Canada, where the case was just heard. A number of interveners, including the Criminal Lawyers Association, who I acted for, made the argument that, well, this is getting dangerously close to, if not right at, creating a fentanyl exception to the warrant requirement. Because the facts of Campbell were that the police had interdicted the transaction. They'd stopped the transaction by arresting person A, right? But the concern was that the fentanyl that the dealer had would at some point in the future make its way to someone else on the streets. So it wasn't about the immediate transaction they were investigating. It was a concern about some future transaction at some future point in time. And that, I think, we argued anyways, really moves you away from the urgency or immediacy that the exigent circumstances doctrine is meant to deal with. right? And remember, it's an exception to the warrant requirement. If you have time to get a warrant, you really should be insisting that the police get a warrant, because that's the judicial control. That's the judicial oversight that we want as part of the criminal process.
It seems like that case is going to be the precursor to the inevitable ChatGPT, like where the police can do phone calls using someone's voice, using AI generate. Like, there's so much in there. That's fascinating.
Yeah, for sure.
I think that's a great point. I mean, you combine in ChatGPT deepfakes, right? If there's no, and that's why a lot of these cases are really just about that. None of them are about preventing the police from doing things wholesale, right? They're not about you can never engage in this technique or you can never get access to this evidence. The cases are about when should there be judicial oversight or control?
For sure. What controls are there?
Or when should there be unfettered access? Right.
Yeah.
If Section 8 doesn't apply, then the police would be free without restriction to create a deep fake or use ChatGPT or whatever the technologies at their disposal to impersonate other people and send messages, send emails, have conversations with people who they are investigating. And you can gather all sorts of information about people, right? You impersonate a profile on a dating website. You impersonate a medical practitioner dispensing medical advice online. You can imagine any number of scenarios.
Oh, I was just thinking in the spousal sponsorship context, if they're trying to determine if a marriage is genuine, you just pretend to be, you just take the person's voice, call them, and start talking about the visa application or something. Mm-hmm. Whole uncharted areas.
Yeah. But the thing that's so confusing is that they can be used for very beneficial things, or they can be used for very nefarious activities. So if somebody wanted to defraud me, they could mimic my voice and have me giving negligent advice to somebody. And then, you know, there's a blackmail situation where I, you know what I'm saying? Like it's but I think that what's very interesting is that the courts have said that's why you have to not be hamstrung by the specific content or the purpose, that there is a balancing involved as to how do you look at things overall. That was the thing that I found super fascinating about the decision in Bykovets.
No, I think that's right. I mean, Bykovets, a lot of the rationale there was, look, we're not saying the police can never have access to IP addresses. Often they should. All we're saying is they have to have a good reason for the IP addresses they want to get access to. It can't be random. It can't be unfettered access. If they have evidence of a crime that needs to be investigated, well, you present that to the issuing justice, you'll get your production order. And then you can get the IP addresses. And I think that same idea carries over well beyond the criminal law. I mean, you always have to be careful how much you extrapolate from the criminal context to non-criminal context. But I think what the core idea is, when you are invading privacy in some way, there has to be, it can't be standardless. It can't be random.
Yeah.
There has to be some basis for it.
Yeah, I thought it was very eloquently said in Bykovets, actually. They say, weighing against these substantive privacy concerns is society's sometimes conflicting but legitimate interest in the need for safety and security. Police should have the investigative tools to deal with crime that is committed and facilitated online. However, requiring the police obtain prior judicial authorization before obtaining an IP address is not an onerous investigative step. I thought that just said so much.
Yeah,
that's right.
The idea that the police could text someone. I mean, we'll have to do a whole future episode on undercover cops and tramp things like that. It's a bit
definitely
beyond the scale, but it's, you know, as a, I guess, a lawyer and a layperson, it's, you know, a bit hair on the neck raising.
For
in
sure.
terms of where the criminal law spills into other areas, you know, going into immigration, it's a, you know, the difference there is in the criminal system, the police have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that someone did X. Whereas immigration law creates more of an obligation on the person, right? So at the border, the person has to establish both that they're admissible to Canada as well that they've complied with the Customs Act. So I told people we were doing this episode, they all asked, can CBSA search my phone? And it's a different context there because of the positive obligation to establish that someone's admissible. Although there is a bit of uncertainty over whether they can compel passwords, but they can certainly seize the phone.
I think so. That's right. I mean, and phones, it's practically speaking, the passwords, passcodes often become the threshold, because if they can't get into the phone, there's not they're not actually getting what they want to get, and your privacy, even if you may be being deprived of your device, is not being invaded to that extent. But the passwords issue has been a fascinating one in the in most of the action, as with the other issues, has been in the purely criminal context, where the police have tried to get orders. When they search someone's phone, they'll get an assistance order saying, compelling the person to disclose their password. And there was a couple lower court decisions out of Ontario, which said that you cannot compel someone constitutionally. If someone is the target, the suspect, you can't compel them to disclose the passcode, because that violates the principle against self-incrimination. You're forcing them to disclose what resides only in their mind, to create evidence against themselves. Now, there have been subsequent cases in the criminal context that said where you're not the suspect, where you're a mere witness to the investigation, different considerations apply, and you may be able to compel someone to disclose their passcode. And then if biometrics, thumbprints, facial recognition, that raises a whole different set of issues, as well. But you leave aside the passcode issue, the searching of devices at the border, has been another one of these areas that has been, really, I think, ripe for more judicial guidance. It would be great if the Supreme Court of Canada took up one of these cases and provided guidance in this area. There's a case called Canfield, from Alberta, that does deal with this, because the Customs Act provides for the power to search. I'm going to forget the exact phraseology, but I think it's search goods at the border. And the question was whether not only the physical device, but the contents of a device can be searched under that power, right? It doesn't specifically say you can review the contents of an electronic device. So how do we interpret that? And if it can be interpreted to allow for the searches of contents of device, is it constitutional? Is that a reasonable search and seizure? And you have kind of conflicting principles at stake here. You have the very high expectations for privacy that we have in our electronic devices. The Supreme Court of Canada has made that clear in a number of cases, that these phones are we carry so much on them, everything from our private conversations to our calendars, years of photographs and videos,
Our
you
own
name it. I mean,
notes and thoughts and musings in the notes app, like everything.
that's right. So that is all on there, in our devices that we carry around with us all the time. And on the other hand, you have a large body of case law that has said, from the Supreme Court, dating all the way back to the AUs, usually in drug importation cases, that our reasonable expectations of privacy at the border are lessened, are diminished, because of the need for countries to control what comes in and out, because of sovereignty in that sense. And so you have these conflicting principles at stake in these cases. Query, it's interesting, you query how much that rationale is applicable to data, right? When they articulated that rationale of the need to control what comes in and out, they were usually talking about drugs. That's why you have a lower expectation of privacy at the border, because we have to prevent drugs from coming in, or other contraband, or other non-contraband that they just want to tax. How much does that apply to digital data that's being stored in our devices, right?
But
You're
this to
not,
me, sorry. This
No,
to me
go ahead.
is where the balancing part becomes so critical, because if you're going to allow that information for the purposes of preventing crime, how does it not also apply to the information that I have on my phone that's privileged? And what if they're after a client of mine and we have communications and I can't control what medium that they use? And so, while it can While the lessening, the diminishing of those protections at the border, may seem very laudable for the purposes of protecting Canadians and all that sort of thing, if you make that allowance, you also have to make that same allowance for the material on my phone, which is about refugee claimants and that sort of thing. So it does get very layered.
No, I think that's absolutely right. So, I mean, we hopefully there's an area where we'll get some guidance in it. The Alberta Court of Appeal struck down this section in Canfield as unconstitutional. Supreme Court denied leave. It's the same, similar or same issues being considered in Ontario right now in a case called Pike that's going to go up to our Court of Appeal and maybe it'll go further from there. So hopefully it's an area where we'll get more guidance soon. The interesting you raise about privilege or issue you raise about privilege is an interesting one. One I've thought about whenever I cross the border, frankly. When I am more vigilant, I will disconnect my device from my work
For
server
sure.
and then just reconnect it on the other side,
It's exactly
right?
right.
Yeah. No, I know lawyers who
So
have
that
the whole
it's,
different sets of phones.
yeah, we're like we've become the
Yeah.
new the new user of the burner phone because
Yeah.
of like fully
That's.
legitimate reasons, you know?
And it can be in areas
That's
you don't
right.
expect. We had a client who got discovered at CBSA for unauthorized work because they opened his phone and went to Google Maps and it showed his location history going to and from an office 5 days a week. Like the amount of stuff on there is crazy. The other
If that's not
area.
a wiretap, I don't know what is. Like, it's a wiretap, like a multi-dimensional wire,
Yeah.
what
Well, I
our
think it's
phone
just
is.
what the expectation is at the border in terms of
Yeah. Well, I mean,
establishing
look,
admissibility.
that's another thing that our phone serves as. It serves as a GPS monitor device, right?
Yeah.
Even when you're not using Google Maps, if you have your location services on, there are, features in the iPhone, hidden layers of the iPhone. If you can click through to enough places and you know about it, that will show exactly where you have
For
been
sure. Well, sometimes
over the
when
last
clients
several
of
months.
mine are trying to do a citizenship application or a permanent resident card renewal, and they're like, I don't really know when I traveled. I was like, do you have location services turned on?
Yeah,
Because if you
that's right.
do, maybe you don't want it to be on, but right now you have the answer to your question.
There's actually a
Yeah,
lawyer at
you
our
can figure it
firm
out.
who leaves it on because they say that it will always show their alibi if they're ever accused of being somewhere where they weren't. They can always show location services.
I feel the
That's
same way.
that. I
Oh,
think
I'm the
that if
opposite.
as a
Mine's
defense
off.
lawyer, well, yeah, I guess it depends on what you're more worried about. But as a defense lawyer, if a client comes in and says, I have an alibi, that's my first question is, let's look at your
For
phone.
sure.
Because
Well,
it's
the other
amazing.
thing is that I have a really bad memory, and so I rely on my phone to fill in the gaps where, like, where was I at that time? I can't remember, and then I go into my, like, I need it. So I totally understand, but Steve, you have like a photographic memory and mine is
Oh,
like a
mine's off. My
disaster.
location services are all, everything is.
Well, of course,
I
because
was
you
part of
have it
that
in your
exodus to
brain.
Signal. That's why, like,
I
I was
know.
part of the Signal exodus in
That's different.
February of whatever year that was.
Yes.
To me, that's different because that's also about other countries, not just about Canada,
Yeah.
because our we I might very much like the way that the Supreme Court of Canada has repeatedly come down on these topics, but I don't know what the other countries are going to say about what the privacy is of that material. So that's why I'm
Yeah.
on Signal.
So before we get into a general discussion on privacy and the time that we have left, I did have one more immigration question that's been on the back of my mind. There's no reported decisions about it. And it involves privacy more in the inland context. So what I mean by that and immigration. So in British Columbia, for example, the provincial nomination program, when someone would apply to be nominated by the province, the PMP may before have written back and said, okay, employer, give us information on your other employees, to which we as the representative would reply saying, well, you're not allowed to do that. It's a breach of the Privacy Act. And the officers would back down. They then brought in a law which said that the British Columbia Immigration Act, and there's similar legislation in I think every other province, which says that officers are able to ask employers whatever they want, basically. And the Immigration Act, it says, including from sources other than the individual the information is about. And as well, the director may require any person who has possession or record of any records, goods, or other things must produce them. Similarly, in the inspection world for employers complying with the temporary foreign worker program, The act says that government inspector employers have a positive obligation to provide any documents that are required.
Can't
As
you
a
even
pro
say, Steve, too, like as another example, the same sort of thing, like when people are making an LMIA application and they need to show genuine efforts of recruitment, they might be asked to say who are the resumes of the other people who applied so that we can determine whether or not this was a truly genuine recruitment.
Yeah, I mean, there they'll redact. They'll ask for the names to be redacted.
Yeah. Still, there's so
Whereas,
much information in those CVs, you could probably reverse engineer who the person was
yeah,
by the
I've actually
redacted.
never had a Service Canada Act for, but anyway, the same principle
Okay.
does
Yeah,
apply
same
there.
principle.
Where,
Yeah, there's lots of
um,
examples
but
like
it's a
this.
little bit, yeah. I mean, in the foreign worker compliance one, there's no active application, and so it's just this standalone. Like the government can come. And basically, according to the law, request whatever they want. So, as a privacy lawyer, if any immigration representatives, businesses who are dealing with requests like this, kind of what would your, not specific, but general advice be regarding privacy law concerns in that setting?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, look, I from a general privacy law perspective, what I'd say is anytime that, first of all, anytime the government is involved, if they're the protagonist, then Section 8 of the Charter is applicable, right? As opposed to outside of a purely private law context. And so then the question is, even if it's a power that's codified in statute, it can be, of course, measured against the requirements of Section 8 of the Charter. The question then is, what's reasonable? Reasonableness is the touchstone for Section 8. Government can engage in searches and seizures. They can invade privacy as long as it's reasonable. And reasonableness is a context-dependent, context-specific concept. So what it means in the criminal law is not going to be the same as what it means in the immigration law. And so there has to be some recognition of that different contextual framework. There are all sorts of established warrant procedures, for example, in the criminal law that you're not going to have in other areas, such as immigration. And so, yes, you have to be mindful of the different contexts. That being said, I think at its core, and we were talking about this a bit earlier when talking about Bykovitz and even privacy and employment law, at its core, what reasonableness is about is there has to be some calibration, some sort of tailoring, right? So that it's not about just you get access to everything whenever, however. There has to be some standard that has to be met, either to narrow the scope of what they can get access to or to narrow the scope of when they can get access to it. There has to be some specific purpose in the regulatory framework to which this request is related in order for it to, I think, comply with a general standard of reasonableness. So I think those are the main things to be on guard about. The other thing I'd say is some of these powers involve getting information from third parties. There was once upon a time, and still is in the United States, this notion that if your information is stored with third parties, you don't have an expectation of privacy in it. Fortunately, Canada has long ago, in our Section 8 jurisprudence, done away with this so-called third-party doctrine. It's simply not tenable anymore in the world in which we live, where so much of our private information we entrust to third parties, whether they're cloud providers or service providers of some sort.
Whether we want to or
And
not, in
so,
fact, we don't have any
yeah,
alternative.
you don't have any alternative. I think that this sort of calls to mind what Justice Cote said in a case called Jones, where she said, we shouldn't have to be digital recluses to maintain some
Yeah, I
semblance of
love that.
privacy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that really captures it.
Yeah. So one example that comes to my mind is that when you're trying to do a citizenship oath, for example, and I don't know if this has evolved, Steve, you might know better than me, but it used to be the case that if you try to do your citizenship oath from a different IP address that was outside of Canada, they would say, well, you can't do your oath because you're supposed to be in Canada. So what I'm thinking is when you get to this question of reasonableness, is that an unreasonable exercise of an invasion of privacy, basically, that the government will be able to look to your IP address. But to me, now that you're saying this, I'm sort of thinking, well, in that situation, they need to make sure that a person is actually in the right country when they make an oath of citizenship. So that might be reasonable. But if they went beyond that to read the rest of their material or to make all of the subsequent connections from that IP address, that would be where the invasion would perhaps crystallize. Does all that make sense?
Yeah. The IP address, I think, is actually going to be, they seem to be granting exceptions on the
For
citizenship
sure,
oath
they
in
are
Canada
now. That's
more.
why I said I thought it was
Where I
evolving.
think it will arise is in all the portals as to who's accessing online
Right.
portals.
That's it. Yeah, you're 100% right. Yeah. Is that actually being done by the applicant or by a ghost consultant? Did they
Yeah.
actually? Yeah. Well, that would actually temper the very ridiculous broadness of the misrepresentation allegation. If you can actually prove that wasn't done in your own name, that was done by somebody else, that's actually beneficial to the applicant.
Yeah. I mean, immigration is
Got a lot
part
of
of,
problems.
I remembered, like at the same time that the previous conservative government wanted to get rid of the census for saying that it was too intrusive into the life of Canadians. And now in immigration applications, you have to disclose everything about you. And if you're from the Gaza program, you have to provide actually all social media accounts to the government, which is unique to that program. I wanted to ask, so well, yeah, I mean, I took, we only have about 5, 10 minutes left. And I wanted to ask, when I did this topic, or I said, told people we're doing this topic, some people are kind of like, oh, privacy, what's that in the modern age? Like,
Right,
it's, I talked about how I did the exodus of, whenever it was like hinted that Facebook had end user data or something with WhatsApp. I deleted WhatsApp, went to Signal, but then my jiu-jitsu gym scheduled events using WhatsApp, so I went back like 2 years later, kind of
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
sheepishly. Do you find like, because you've been practicing for a while, is it like, do you find that there's a difference, like a generational younger lawyers coming in have different takes than like older lawyers?
Yeah, I'm not, I think there is a difference. And I think the difference weighs in favor of a stronger expectation of privacy. And this is somewhat, maybe unexpected, but among the younger generation when they're using certain technologies. And I say that because, older generations, that let's say, I think it's no longer the case, but at the advent of, text messaging platforms, let's say, older generations who didn't really text all the time, but would just pick up the phone and call somebody, I think we're, as a generality, more prone to thinking, well, if you're going to put it in writing, if you're going to type it out and send it
Sure.
off, you must know it's not private. Because why would you do that? If you want to keep it private, you pick up the phone and call somebody. Whereas the younger generation, this is how they communicate,
100%.
most of the time.
Yeah.
And so to them, this is just a private conversation. And there's more of an expectation that that will be kept private. They understand the difference between sending something via, a direct messaging platform, whether it's SMS or Instant Messenger on Facebook or some other platform that I'm too old to be aware of, the difference between that and posting on someone's Facebook wall, right? The difference between putting out a tweet for public consumption and sending a DM to somebody.
You're wrong about
There is
one thing only, which is
difference.
they don't use Facebook because, according to my daughter, that's for old people. But they
That's
like
what I'm coming
Snapchat.
to realize too.
Exactly. They like Snapchat precisely because everything that you've said disappears almost immediately. And if somebody tries to capture it, you know that they're doing that. And so there is that stronger expectation of privacy. That's, I know, why my kid likes it. There is a stronger expectation of privacy, and they will take one another to task if they violate one another's privacies. Like if somebody has shared something that was intended privately with a group, the group will take that person down. And they'll say that was
Interesting.
inappropriate for you to do. Like they have debates about this among her grade. It's very sophisticated, actually.
It's
That
interesting because it's like,
that's
as
very
Gerald
interesting.
said, it's counterintuitive to what you may see in the media, where I feel like the media presents it as like, Oh, young people are using an app
No.
controlled by the Chinese Communist Party, and they don't care that their data is stored in a foreign country, is the way like the media presents it.
I
So
know,
it's,
not my kid anyways, and not her entire grade. They're all very much they're not naive to this. They're wise, and they might learn new things and then change their habits, but it's not because they're ignorant.
What's she going to think about
Well,
you
and that,
talking
yeah.
about her on the
She's gonna love it, actually. She's being asked, why don't you say
podcast?
what I think about Gaza? That's what she's like, very much gonna love it.
You know, my son's still too young for social media, so I can't talk about him. But I do think that this speaks to a real natural human desire, right? There is always going to be human instinct for privacy. People are always going to want the space to try out ideas, to share intimate emotions and thoughts that aren't just automatically exposed to the world. And they can want that while also wanting access to technologies that, by their very nature, leave more of a
For
digital
sure.
trace and footprint. I don't think those two things are in conflict. I think they can coexist.
No.
We can want both, and we should be able
For
to have
sure,
both,
have
right? And
both.
I think
It's
that
the third
this
thing
does
that we
get
want that
to.
complicates it, which is that we don't want to pay for it. And so
Yeah.
that's
Well,
what.
that's a whole different
Because
podcast.
then we become the customer and they need our data.
Of course.
Yeah.
But
Well,
the
I
other
mean, this
thing I
does,
want
I
to go.
think.
Sorry.
No, sorry. I was just going to say this does get to one sort of core principle of Section 8 jurisprudence, which I think maps over to all other areas of privacy law, which is it's often said in the case law, this is not a descriptive question, it's a normative question. So the question isn't so much, what can we realistically expect give of privacy given all that we know about big tech and how much they store and how they sell our information to other providers and how much the government can access with their tools of state surveillance. That's not the question. The question is, how much privacy should we be entitled to expect in the society in which we want to live? And that's really the key question, I think, for privacy law.
So the thing that I think is interesting, because Steve talked about how to map this onto the immigration sector and how I really love the point you made, Steve, about how immigration lawyers tend to accept things as they are too much. And so the way that things have been going, very opposite to the way that they've gone in the criminal sector, is that the kinds of restrictions on CBSA are getting lower and lower. Stuff that material that can't be used by the RCMP because it wasn't obtained properly, the CBSA is using that same material to make admissibility allegations, and we're kind of allowing it to happen without saying that there is a limit. So, I mean, we're at the almost at the anniversary of the Suresh decision, and that's been something that that are refugees entitled to charter protection, and that was decided. Yes, of course they are, but I think that for us to robustly litigate for the protection of their Section 8 rights as well, I understand that that will make CBSA's job more difficult, but I'm okay with that if it means that also people aren't being accused of organized criminality based on information that was private, and that, it's like, and again, it's not just because I think that they should be able to get away with crimes, but it's more just the overarching implications of that. Because sometimes they're used in very sad cases where, it shouldn't be. It should, I think the reasonable expectation of Canadians is that that would not be put forward. Anyways, that was my big rant, but.
No, it was a good one. I think, I mean, there are areas where it is like in the notion of the equivalent of a Stinchcomb defense is still relatively new in immigration, but that came in that Brown decision. So that would be an example of where I don't even think the decision used Stinchcomb, but just that they imposed a positive obligation on CBSA to disclose all the evidence that was relied on. So that is an example of where principles from other areas can apply to immigration. And I think there's been a lot said today that will definitely give people food for thought. I'm definitely going to be thinking about the idea of ChatGPT creating fake, people, cops, pretend police officers pretending to be officers.
Well, I'm going to
It'll
be
be on
thinking
my
about your
mind the rest of the
Stinchcomb
day, the
defense.
idea of what I think of police intercepting or texting from someone's phone.
I know we've all watched The Wire and Chicago PD and all those shows that I'm like, go. But it's like now I'm seeing very much the other side of it, and it makes a ton of sense.
Well, I mean, I already know I'm going to be emailing you when that decision comes out.
Totally. I'm going to be emailing you a fair bit, actually. Yeah.
Well,
In the meantime, I hope everyone enjoys whatever part of the eclipse they are able to witness today.
yes,
Yeah.
we're
And
getting
that's my
closer to the
background.
time.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
I don't even know when it is in Vancouver, but
we're
if
not
there is
getting it.
one,
It's
nothing?
pouring rain. I think we get a
Okay.
sliver of an eclipse. But
Okay.
yeah, thanks. Thank you very much for coming on. This was fun.
Absolutely
Oh, thank you
brilliant.
for having me. It
Yeah.
was a great discussion. Thank you.
Yeah,
Take
definitely. Take care. Bye-bye.
care. Bye.